This is the Halloween episode of the Defensive Security Podcast. It's so long, it's scary. It is Monday, October 28th, 2013, and this is episode 40 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, I'm joined tonight by Mr. Andrew Callett.
Good evening, and hey, it's almost Halloween, so by the time you hear this, happy Halloween.
Absolutely. And as usual, also, the thoughts and opinions we express on this podcast are ours and don't represent those of our employers. So, boy, you know, it's been quite a week for me personally. I've got a couple of pearls of wisdom to drop on everybody. And, you know, number one is malware that is not detectable is not detectable. That's number one.
Wait, I'm a little unclear. Can we cover that again?
Yeah. So, malware that can't be detected by antivirus can't be detected by antivirus. It came up this week, right?
Wow.
Okay. And number two, don't let your employees back up to network connected NASs at their house, which are also accessible on the internet.
It seems like there might be some good stories around both of those items.
Yeah, this is just hypothetical, right?
Hypothetically speaking.
Hypothetical. I mean, my friend Bob told me about these.
Right. Sure.
So, moving on.
I'm still stunned by that anti-malware revelation. If you can't detect it.
If you can't detect it, you can't detect it.
It's not detectable.
Yeah. It's...
Well, you know, you need to fix that, Jerry. Can you get that crazy. Fixed by, I don't know, I'll give you till Wednesday.
Sure, I'm working on it.
I got some
minions.
Yeah, go buy something. I'll fix that for us, will you?
I've got some minions working on it.
I won't tell you who, but I had an RFP come in when I was at a random employer, and this was for a random customer. That basically was, in essence, we need a solution that finds all malware with 100% accuracy on all platforms, including mobile, Windows, you know, XOS, Solaris, Linux, AIX.
You know, I bet they do need that.
And I was like, well, good luck. I tell you what, if I could figure out how to do this, I'd be a billionaire. Because, yeah, you know, that's pretty much the point of the whole freaking industry.
That's right.
Anyway,
boy, you got some customers that have some big expectations.
No, that was purely, you know, much like your stories.
Sorry.
And who says it's a current customer with my current employer? Are you trying to get me fired, Jerry? Is that what you're trying to do?
It was, yes. That...
We're going to have to make all of our listeners now sign an NDA. All of them.
Every one of them. Before.
I'll get the paperwork started.
Okay.
So,
first story.
Let's go to stories.
This first story comes to us from Network World, and the title is Federal Security Breaches Traced to User Noncompliance. And there's a number of stats thrown in here. There was a survey commissioned by Akamai, and there were really two stats that stuck out to me. And by the way, you know, the context of this is the federal government, but after reading through the story and, you know, my personal experience in the private sector, I can tell you the challenges are the same. So the two stats that stuck out to me was that 49% of breaches were related to noncompliance of users, and one-third of employees surveyed circumvented security precautions. And so, you know, basically This is the the never-ending problem of security impeding business and creative business people figuring out how to work around security, and that ends in disaster.
Yeah, it pretty much is. That's my takeaway as well, is that if your security is too burdensome, your users are going to find a way around them, and they will be supported by their management when they do that in most cases. And so you could look at that a couple ways. Either A, you don't have enough backing from executive management for whatever sort of controls you're putting in place for whatever reason. And if you don't, that means that your security controls are probably not in line with the business needs, or whatever security controls you put in place are too burdensome and are impacting other staff's ability to be successful. So they're going to find a way to do their job. So it behooves you to, as a security professional, to understand what it is they're trying to do and see if you can provide a way to do it for them that is secure, rather than just blocking them. It was interesting. The other thing I found, one other stat I thought, was that 66% of users describe their agency security protocols as burdensome and time-consuming. And just a shade more than that said that it takes longer to complete certain tasks because of security roadblocks. Now, that's a perception issue, right?
Yes.
So, and to me, that you can talk about that as, well, they feel that way because they don't feel the value of the information is worth the level of security. Right. So if we equate this back to the physical world with the TSA and going through airport security, most people, not us weirdos, most people would say that it's worth the hassle, right, to fly. I don't, but that's because I understand security theater. So for me, there's probably a bit of a perception issue here that if they're saying their protocols are too burdensome, it's because they're not seeing the value of the security protocols around the data either. So that could be something that's a lack of understanding by the user's part, it's not being explained well, or it could just very well be just way too burdensome and needs to be done in a different method, is one thing I was thinking about.
Yeah. You know, when I read that, what struck me was, in what circumstance is additional security measures not more burdensome than not having those security measures? I really can't come up with a lot. I mean, maybe antivirus that runs in the background.
Yeah.
You know, in most cases, it's going to be a hassle. I mean, the fact that you have to use a password to sign into things,
yep,
is an inconvenience, right? And so I'm not terribly surprised. You know, I guess the one thing I would debate with this article, and you know, overall I think the message is right, there seems to be this perception that, or at least assertion, that IT people or security people are too focused on the threats and not enough on the usability, and so, for instance, they made the point that, you know, protecting data from being lost is in the top 10 or among the top concerns, but making security user friendly was, I think they said, in the 40 percentile range. And you know, I'm actually surprised that it's that high.
Well, you know, you could look at it like this. Let's say you walk into your office building and you have to go through a little swipe card checkpoint, and you decide you don't want to do that. So you start hopping the checkpoint every day. What do you think is going to happen? Somebody in HR or your management or somebody is going to come have a little chat with you, right? Now, does that happen in the virtual world when we're dealing with data and PCs? Rarely. And I see that as a failure of leadership to enforce and back these policies.
That's a good point. That's a good point. We, you know, as an organization, we have to find the right balance. And once we find that right balance, we all have to toe the line, right? So if,
and as I was informed in writing, you're no longer allowed to kill users as an example and put their head on a pike in front of the building. I get that. Thank you. I understand now. I personally think it's a wonderful deterrent. It worked fine for many years. Now they tell me I can't do that. It's fine. Things change. I get that.
It's a different time now, man.
But what that tells me is, maybe we should also maybe be a little cynical about this and say that users are going to attempt to go around the controls no matter what. And how do we deal with that if they do it? Or how do we prevent them from doing that?
You know? Well, I think that comes back to what you were saying, is that it really takes management buy-in and management to have your back, right? Because if they don't, you don't really have a security program. You kind of have a set of suggestions.
But if you're still reliant on the user to make the right call on something, like not send files to Dropbox, and you don't have a technological control to stop that, you're going to get burned.
No, that's a good point.
You know, so if these guys are circumventing protocols or security protocols, well, then I would wonder what protocols are being circumvented to what level, right? Are they big or small? And is there technological controls that we can put in place to prevent that level of, circumvention? Right. I almost said circumcision, but that would have been wrong.
That would have been very wrong.
Yeah.
So. And then obviously if you detect things happening, there needs to be consequences depending on, what it is.
Yeah. Let me know how that works out, especially, with like sales guys.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I always forget about the salespeople.
Yeah. I understand that he killed three of your relatives and then ran over your dog, but he had 150% of his quota last quarter. So,
and it is the end of the quarter. And
yeah, we'll get you a new dog.
Oh boy. All right. We beat that one to death.
Yes.
So to speak. The next story we have is about CryptoLocker. If you pay attention to the news at all, and that includes, the mainstream news, you're probably familiar with CryptoLocker. I think it's interesting to bring up because, for a long time, viruses, most malware, obviously other than, the really advanced stuff, has been kind of written by amateurish people. And so for a long time, we have seen ransomware out in the world. We've seen, there's been quite a lot of FBI and, those long history of that kind of malware that encrypts your files. But, those were all really pretty lame. And there's quite a few tools that will actually go through and unlock those files because, the malware wasn't very well designed. And so for a long time, we've benefited as an industry and as a civilization by the malware authors really, I guess, not having a clue for for lack of a better way to put it. But CryptoLocker is different. I mean, this is a fancy piece of malware that was written basically how somebody with a clue about cryptography and IT systems would actually write it. This is kind of scary.
Yeah, it even has an elegant little interface. It's some really well done ransomware.
Yeah, and
but you can tell that it's written by a non-native English speaker though. There's a few translation issues. Your important files encryption produced on this computer. What? Right, things like that. But it's pretty well done. A lot of these you could go and you could attack their implementation of the encryption. But here, no, this is pretty solid. Individual private keys per box, phoning home to get a new key pair each time, real consequences that those files cannot be recovered if you don't pay them. It's pretty heavy.
Yeah, exactly. That's the scary thing is that at least until additional research uncovers something that we're not currently aware of, there really is not a way to attack this. It's done very well, and you have as you mentioned, you have a very limited amount of time to pay the fine, which I think is $300, 300 euros, or 2 bitcoins, which also is interesting that they're now accepting bitcoins. We haven't really seen that before that I'm aware of. And that's also probably going to make the flow of money more obscure, right? So, potentially we could start seeing these things only taking bitcoins and making, getting back to who's perpetrating this a lot more difficult. But there's some interesting things here because, as you mentioned, when the files are encrypted, there's a communication back to a command and control server, and the command and control server only provides the public key down to the computer, and those files are encrypted with a public key. And the only way you're going to get a key to decrypt it is if you get that key off of the server. And one of the interesting things that's been happening is, as the malware researchers are, you know, sinkholing some of these domains, some people who are in fact infected are losing the ability to pay for their files.
Oops.
And so, you know, the law of unintended consequences is in full play here. And by the way, I've heard that there are quite a lot of people affected by this. You know, there's a lot of rumors and whatnot going around about people going to get money packs at the store and, you know, finding out that, you know, they're the fifth one that day.
Wow.
Getting a check for $300.
It's effective. It really is. So this particular article we're looking at is off of Kapersky's blog. And, you know, one thing that I found really interesting is the breakdown of victims per country. And the U.S. and Great Britain are by far the highest number of victims, which makes sense. Wealthy countries, a lot of disposable income, a lot of important data, very reliant on the data. You know, they know what they're going after. It's nasty, nasty stuff.
And the reason I also wanted to bring this up, not only because it's, I think, indicative of a potential change in strategy, but also that the fundamentals are still important, right? And backing up your data is still really important. We don't usually think about backups in the context of security, but, you know, when all goes wrong, you got to have a backup.
So let's think about this for a second, right? Assuming, you know, you've got non-enterprise level backups and you've got actually something like, I don't know, Mozy or Carbonite or something, and it encrypts and it does differential updates based on changes, right?
Yes.
Well, Mozy and Carbonite has no idea that that file change was it being encrypted and overwriting the old one as opposed to you just updating a file. So if you've got always on backup that's always looking for changes, you could very well end up overwriting your clear text version of the file with the ciphertext version of the file and then be really screwed.
Yeah. Now, I think a lot of those services do versioning, and so you can restore back to a point in time.
Yeah, that would be the key, right? You would need to make sure you've got versioning here.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that kind of reminds me going back to my hardcore IT days, you know, with replicating data between SANs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when your backup plan is the replica of your EMC SAN in another data center, and all of a sudden all of your data is encrypted in both spots, you know, you are indeed screwed.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem, right? And worth thinking about. But you know, at the end of the day too, when we talk about defense against this, you know, this is the payload. This is the exploit. Or I'm sorry, the payload that comes in after the exploit. So, but they don't talk about it at all. There's probably a thousand different ways to do it. Is how did the initial exploit happen? So, you know, this goes back to the same typical blocking and tackling, right? You know, patches and good anti-malware tools and not clicking on things you shouldn't click on. And
so my friend Bob has some firsthand experience with this one, and he can tell you. And he told me directly that it most commonly comes in as a phishing email.
Which makes sense. You know, that Bob gets around. He sees some things.
Well, Bob is, he's a busy guy.
We might have to interview him on the show one day.
Yes.
But, phishing emails make sense. I could see that. Interesting stuff.
Let's move on. Next is PHP, yet another really major story that's been all over the news. What I find interesting in this is not necessarily the hack itself, but the reaction and kind of everything else around it. And, you know, so to give a little bit of detail, if you're not familiar, PHP.net, I think everybody probably is very familiar with what PHP is, was compromised. And, you know, basically the way it was found was Google started flagging the site as malicious. And initially the PHP developers totally rejected the ideas, or the idea that their site was compromised. And they, in fact, railed against Google to stop falsely flagging their site. And one of the security vendors, I forget which one at the moment, actually had to send them PCAPs of the actual malicious traffic coming off of their site before they completely accepted responsibility. But what happened was somehow, and I don't think we actually know how yet, but the attackers had injected a malicious JavaScript file, which does the normal, you know, iframe injection thing that redirects to a third-party site. And those third-party sites were indeed hacked themselves and hosted in on a server in Moldova, of all places.
Which I hear is beautiful this time of year.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely beautiful. The malware is awesome.
It's in full bloom.
Yes. And in this particular case, the unwitting visitors to PHP were served with a wonderful exploit kit.
Tasty exploit kit.
Which kind of makes me wonder if this was some kind of a targeted attack against PHP or people who use PHP. We may not know for quite some time if that actually is the case, you know, but potentially that could be.
So you're thinking it might have been a waterhole attack?
Absolutely. That was the first thing that I started thinking about is, you know, who would benefit from that? And, you know, honestly, the options are limitless. There's some other interesting aspects to this, other than the fact that it took quite some time for the PHP people to come to terms with the reality of their situation. And by the way, you know, it's really easy to throw rocks at people after a situation has happened, right? So, I mean, I do quite a lot of incident response, and so I'm not really trying to bash on these guys, but here's an opportunity for us to learn from, right? And so in this particular case, it was really complicated because on their site, they did some automation where periodically they would refresh the content of the servers out of their Git repository. And so the malware kept getting overwritten with legitimate content. And so, you know, only a portion of people who went to the site were getting the malware, depending on...
So is that then... Are you then saying that after they would refresh the content, the malware would somehow have to re-exploit the site?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes. But those are some details that we don't actually understand yet.
Yeah.
And there are some other concerns I have. I mean, I've been a pretty big PHP supporter for a very, very long time. And this is kind of concerning to me because, you know, they have said that the source repository wasn't compromised. However, one of the servers that was compromised was their Git server. Right? So I'm not entirely sure how they came to that conclusion. I hope, in fact, they really do know what they're doing and were accurate about that. But the other thing that was kind of coming out and is causing a lot of consternation is that PHP provides binaries and tarballs on their site that you can download, and they provide hashes, right?
Sure.
Like MD5 hashes.
Right, but now how do you trust it?
Well, exactly.
So maybe, you know, yet again, we get to the circle of trust issue, right? Of if the site is compromised and the authentication verification item is compromised, how do you trust any of it?
Yeah, exactly. And so it kind of makes you wonder, well, what purpose does that hash actually serve? It really doesn't do anything. The only thing that you really have is some vendors are now actually digitally signing code, right? And that's where, you know, that's about the only thing.
Not
you can
that we haven't
do.
Seen a lot of certs get
good point.
Lately. Yeah,
good point.
Yeah,
but it would be better. I mean, this is a trivial case where if you own a footprint on the web server, it would be trivial for you to just update the MD5 or the SHA-1, whatever hash it was, when you replace the files that are offered for download.
Sure. So, interesting. Yep. To be continued.
To be continued. We will we'll come back to this as we learn more for sure. The next story comes from PC World, and this is a story about DDoS. And the subject of the story is that DDoS attacks are getting shorter in duration, but much larger in volume. And so one of the points they make here is that there are four times as many DDoS attacks in 2013 that exceed 20 gigabits per second than there were last year. And that's a pretty significant increase. And I think Arbor was saying that they saw a 191 gigabits per second attack. You know, this is not playing around here.
Yeah, there's a Back to the Future quote in there somewhere, but I'm not going to make it. Yeah, and this reinforces what we've said before on the show, which is if you are relying on customer prem equipment to stop a DDoS, you will fail. You have to work with your ISP because you've got to get something big enough to sustain and stop that. If it's already hitting your customer prem, they're going to play who's got a bigger pipe. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah, you're going to lose that fight.
Yeah, I mean, unless you've already got some sort of pre-existing. But hell, we're talking 200 gig, man. We're starting to get to some small tier carrier capability there. Yeah. That's wild. And DDoS is one of those really hard problems to solve. And I think we're going to see more of it, especially as, you know, what we've seen a little bit as a distraction for other attacks.
Right.
I think we can see. So I think they will grow. That is my prediction, is that they will get bigger and meaner and nastier. And, you know, you've got to have an effective plan, whether that be through infrastructure that you can swing to new locations, whether having your key stuff out on your content delivery network providers, whether you've got agreements with your ISP, whether you've got your, you know, business stuff separated from your internet facing stuff, something, right? Just think about what happens if you start getting DDoSed.
Yeah. And just to follow on to that, once the DDoS attack starts, it's really too late to think about a response.
That's a great point.
If you haven't done anything, you're going to be down for a long time, or however long the attack is going to go on for, because this is not a fast problem to solve. As you mentioned, preparing for a DDoS attack or surviving a DDoS attack is all about preparation, not about response.
Which gives me an idea. We should pitch to, like, you know, Nat Geo Channel, Discovery Channel, DDoS Preppers as a new reality show.
Fantastic.
We could have all sorts of various people across the country preparing for the next DDoS.
Brought to you by Akamai.
And Arbor. I can't help but, you know, seeing the plethora of, you know, doomsday prepper type shows out there these days that, you know, although anytime they've ever tried to make a TV show about what we do or anything around what we do, it fails miserably. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Because we're boring on TV.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. So anyhow, you know, I can tell you from personal experience, it's becoming very challenging to run your own, you know, if you have a site of any significance, to run it outside the context of a CDN, right? So, you know, a Cloudflare or an Akamai, it's really becoming extremely difficult. And you know, I think those kinds of companies are really well positioned into the future. So, you know, if you're not already thinking about that, I think you might want to.
So we're saying that those companies are behind the DDoSes? Is that what you're implying?
Well, I mean, no more or no less than AV companies are behind the viruses.
I knew it. Hey, in other news, cattle mutilations are up.
Cue the crickets. I don't even know what to say to that.
Well, it's a movie reference. Some people in the audience will get it, and they will chuckle. The rest will just look at me oddly like most people do. We'll move along.
Moving on. So, we did not do a attack of the week last week, but we had decided to do a discussion on advanced malware.
It's a tough one. It's a big discussion. It's like we were alluding to at the beginning of the show. You know, if you can find a surefire solution to this, you've become a billionaire pretty quickly.
Yeah, and that's the one thing I wanted to come right out of the gate with and say is technology is not going to solve this for you.
I would say that there's no silver bullet. There's no buy an advanced malware solution in a box thing. But I think layers of different technologies can help.
Yes, I agree with that.
So let's take it from the top and say, what do we mean by advanced malware? Because that is a bit of a squishy term. What do you think it means, Jay?
Well, I was thinking about the same question. And, you know, I'm of two minds, right? Because I think when most people think about advanced malware, in their mind, they're thinking Stuxnet, Flame, Gauss, Shamoon, Dark Soul, right?
What did you just call me?
Ooh, Shamoon. But, you know, realistically, can you say that, you know, CryptoLocker is not advanced or Zeus is not advanced? You know, so part of there is a very important Symantec, not the company, problem that we have to wrestle with, because there are some important implications there. In my mind, advanced malware is, you know, is really intended for stealth and persistence. And that could be in the context of, you know, an intelligence operation or a organized crime thing like Zeus.
So would you say that advanced malware, one component, would have to be some sort of control channel?
You know, I wrestled with that question too. I'm kind of ambivalent on that point. You know, obviously, if you think about something like Shamoon and Dark Soul, they really didn't have a command and control channel, right? But mm-hmm. I would put them in the advanced bucket.
So the only thing we can really agree on what you're saying here is that advanced malware basically is smarter than current AV technology.
Yeah, and that's a very troublesome statement, because almost every bit of malware now is smarter than and so you know, hence my problem, right?
All right. So if we attack that, let's do it. Let's take a problem statement this way.
Okay.
AV used to be an acceptable tool to stop malware. Now it no longer is. Okay. So what do you do instead? Right? Is that sort of, yeah, you know, that I think can encompass the core of our discussion here, which is that if advanced malware can blow past your current AV, what do you do?
Right. Okay. Right. Now, I think there is a subtlety there, right? Because there are different shades of advanced.
Are you writing 50 Shades of Malware?
You know, that's a good idea. There are 50 shades of malware.
I'm sure somebody out there has already used that joke.
But sure. Probably so.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, when we start getting into the meat of it, in many ways, I think it's fair to say that advanced malware is a multi-phase thing, and part of the first phase can be a very simple exploit, yes, that leads to the quote-unquote advanced malware later being loaded onto the machine, right? So if you start breaking down the phases of the, if you want to use the kill chain analogy, or if you want to use the attack chain analogy, or whatever analogy you want to use, there's typically multiple phases that I have seen, at least. And assuming, let's just, for the sake of argument here, say that most of the quote-unquote advanced malware has some sort of command and control or exfiltration channel or some sort of callback channel. You know, so you've got a couple things. You've got the original exploit. You've got that callback in some way of that original exploit to grab more advanced code to further exploit that box. And then that continues, can go laterally, continues to download. And then you've got whatever sort of purpose of that malware may be. It may be an exfiltration of data. It may be, you know, like CryptoLocker. It may be all sorts of things that, that again, may also have some network activity involved, right? So when I start thinking about advanced malware, and I know I jumped a little further into the meat of this really quickly, you know, you've got each of those phases are something you could potentially attack as a defender.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, there isn't a good way to talk about this, and you know, at least from a flow perspective.
So well, then I quit.
We'll probably be jumping around a little bit. But okay, fine.
That was it.
So
turn off Java. Problem solved. You're done. There you go. Home.
There you go. We solved the problem. No more ask toolbar for you.
Seriously. Oracle. Oh. All right, but so go ahead.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to mention about just a comment about something you said, which is a really good point that I think a lot of people don't fully understand, is that particularly with the more advanced adversaries, their initial attack is not with their advanced stuff, right? They are not going to burn, you know, their 0 days or the really advanced malware with a, you know, trolling in a phishing attack or in a watering hole attack. That is going to be placed on the specific system that they want to target, right? So after they've got a footprint with their poison ivy or, you know, whatever rat or whatever else they have that's established a beachhead inside the network, you know, that's when they start using the more advanced stuff.
Yeah, certainly. Now, of course, there's no absolutes, right? You could you know, all sorts of different behaviors from all sorts of different groups, but in general, I think that's fair. Yep. So in my mind, you know, step one for defending against advanced malware is trying to stop that initial exploit, if at all possible, right? You know, and so that's all the basic blocking and tackling. For God's sake, patch, please. I mean, how many advanced malwares do we see that come initially from not even 0 days, but known patched vulnerabilities that are being exploited because the patch hasn't been applied yet?
Right.
And I get it. Patching in and of itself is a risk, right? Patching in and of itself is a hassle. But we're, in my mind, getting to a point where not patching is starting to become a greater risk than potential disruption from patching.
Definitely, you know, so.
Not to get off on a whole other rant, but
no, I think you're on a good point. And I've actually been having some discussions with different people,
including Bob.
Yeah. About it was actually a YouTube video that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago. It was about a presentation at a security conference that was discussing, you know, we were very, as a community, we're infatuated with patching the CVSS 8, 9s, and 10s.
Right.
And, you know, we never seem to get around to those 4s and 5s, but the 4s and 5s are what keep getting exploited.
I will tell you, one of the things that I'm most pleased about as a security industry, although it has its downsides, but I love the concept of the app stores with auto-updating.
Yes.
I think for the vast majority of users, that helps tremendously in keeping things up to date and patched.
I agree.
And I think it's one thing that's going to save our ass on mobile devices.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's worked out for Apple relatively well so far.
Yeah. We'll see.
So mostly.
Yeah.
So following on to your point, you know, I think there are some really key things, like, you know, we we know that attackers in general, well, you're talking about government attackers or organized crime attackers, they're moving to the web en masse, right? Obviously, phishing is still a big problem, but they are en masse moving to the watering hole style attack. And what do those attacks use? They use PDF reader, Java, and Flash, and to a lesser extent, you know, unpatched vulnerabilities in Internet Explorer and, you know, some of the other browsers.
And why do they use them? Because they work.
They work.
Right. And it's that simple, right? And then all they need to do is drop a loader. And right. Then they can go to town.
So if you want to, you know, if you want to cut off a lot of your exposure, don't install Java in your browser. Don't allow Flash. Does your business computer need to have Flash? I mean, really?
Well, you know, and I think the reality is for most folks, I don't even know if that's a logical, intentional decision. I think so many PCs and so many boxes are on autopilot in so many organizations that, you know, if you went to most organizations of any size and said, tell me all your assets in a Flash loader right now, I bet they couldn't tell you.
I mean,
they
don't
could tell
doubt
you
that at all. I don't doubt that at all.
They could tell you for sure iOS devices don't have it. They would know that.
Yes. That's true.
And this goes back to our earlier story, which is that, you know, you've got a security control that says no Flash, no Java. Then, you know, Suzanne in accounting needs to go to some site to do something. That vendor management uses Java, and then it's got to be loaded. And then is it run secure? You know, you get in trouble in a hurry of... It works. It just doesn't work so well at scale. But I agree with you. If you can not have it, don't have it, right? But let's assume that you do have it, right? So what's your next step? You've got the initial exploit. Boom. Now it comes down to, can you spot that callback channel? This is a much more challenging thing, I think, right now.
Definitely so. Definitely so. You know, I do want to come back to, you know, some more ideas on prevention. In a minute, but let's explore this detection thread.
We can go back.
No. I think this is good. It's a good time, right? So some things I think about is, you know, turning your IDS or IPS deployments inward. You know, one interesting thing about systems that are compromised is that they're usually used as a platform to launch attacks or probe within a network. And a lot of times, you know, you might not be able to detect the initial point of entry, but sometimes, and actually I would say a lot of times, you can see the secondary effects inside your networks because they don't really make sense in the context of a intranet.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of times you can, you know, you can trigger some workflow to go and pay somebody a visit when their system starts launching scans or whatever.
Right. And this comes back to having really good instrumentation, which we've talked about a lot, right?
Yes.
You know, and SIMs or security analytics or good IPS internally or IDS, even good, you know, sort of firewalling at the core with some next-gen firewalling, if you get fast enough boxes, can give you some alerts on this. I think the concept here is that, you know, assuming you're going to get popped, try to detect it as quickly as you can, and ideally, you know, have instrumentation deep in the environment so you're not just watching at the edge, which can also help you, though. Watching at the edge outbound can be very helpful, right? You know, especially if you've got default routes, following your path out on default routing and examining that data can definitely be helpful depending on what it's doing, you know? You could get into other things too. Like if there's, you can subscribe to various blacklists of known CNC domains and load those into DNS. You can run tools like Infoblox, which has, you know, DNS type firewalls. There's a lot of things you can do to start watching for this traffic on the way back out, assuming that it is calling out.
One of the ones I really like, and this was Johannes Ulrich is really big on monitoring your DNS traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I really like is the concept of looking for rapid NX replies to a system.
Sure.
And what that's usually indicative of is a DGA, right? So some kind of DGA malware, mm-hmm. trying to locate a, you know, an active command and control host.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anybody could look at LinkedIn and figure this out. I worked at Dumbala for about a year and a half, and a lot of the detection technique when I was there, which was many, many years ago, so this is not current by any means, was based on understanding the DNS behavior of malware, advanced malware, you know, APTs, persistent malware, whatever you want to call it. And we knew how to look for the lookups for CNC type domains.
Right.
Which is a very elegant approach, but you have to make sure that you are in the right spot. For instance, the problem with DNS is that as soon as you jump through one DNS hop, you no longer have the original source IP.
Right.
Because it's a chain, right? It's like a proxied DNS thing. And the problem I ran into, and I still run into this all the time, is that most companies don't think much about their DNS infrastructure at all. It just works. It's like plumbing. It just works, right? And they just ignore it. But I think there's a lot of value, at least at this point in time, for watching DNS for malware. However, I do think that at some point they will shift away from that because this is starting to become a known measurement point.
Yeah, I agree with this. That.
You know, it's an arms race.
But for now, it is something that is beneficial. You know, there's another thing that I like to do, and this is really boring, by the way, and that is look at your AV logs, right? And a lot of people are going to say, well, God, that's such a dumb idea. You know, if your AV logs it, it detected it, and it probably prevented it. Well, the point there is not that, but if you're seeing a lot of detections on a particular endpoint, something's going on, right?
What do you mean detections?
So if, let's say you've got Symantec or McAfee, right? And a particular workstation mm-hmm. is throwing a bunch of detections on either the same thing or different things.
So you're implying that there's a dropper there trying to load stuff.
Well, there's either a dropper there or the system is being remotely managed, or the user is doing dumb stuff that is really risky.
Yeah.
And in most circumstances really warrants somebody taking a look at what's going on.
That's true. You know, one thing that I am liking, though, there is definitely limitations, but I do like the sandbox techniques and the sandbox technology that exists out there. And I would say right now FireEye is probably the strongest in that market for pure sandboxing, though many, many, many other vendors are now adding it. Everybody from McAfee to, you know, you name it, Checkpoint, Palo Alto, I think SourceFire, a lot of people are adding this sort of sandbox where the concept is, you know, you stand up basically a virtual machine that or a bunch of virtual machines that simulate your target environment, and as executable code comes through some monitoring point, whether it be via email or web, you grab it, you throw it into the virtual machine, and the industry term is to detonate it and see what it does and model its behavior. I think that's a pretty effective technique. I don't think it'll catch everything, but I like it. I think it'll catch a lot. The downside is it doesn't necessarily stop it immediately. If it's certainly brand new, most of those still work where, you know, that's flowed onto the endpoint. But the fact is that, you know, and whether or not it actually succeeded on the endpoint is a secondary question that may or may not be, you know, you may have some instrumentation to pick that up. But the concept is at least you can know that this piece of malware came in, got past all of your perimeter AV, and was profiled to be malware in certain ways on these you know, virtual machines. And then you can start tracking down, okay, who did it go to? Who grabbed it? Right. Is this box compromised? I think at this point in time, it's a very effective technique. I think over time, the bad guys will start learning how to evade, even though these sandbox manufacturers say, no, we know how to do anti-evasion techniques and such. But, you know, that will happen.
I agree. I can tell you, I've had some firsthand experience with malware that couldn't be unpacked by AV companies, and so I wonder how some of these some of these sandboxes would actually deal with that. It would be pretty interesting. But I agree in general. I've seen firsthand these things actually work really very, very well. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I've only had experience with FireEye, but I do know that, you know, this is becoming kind of a crowded market now.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is it's one of the few technologies from a malware assessment that is kind of new and innovative, and I think it has some legs to go, but I do think, like you said, there's some limitations.
Yeah, and their marketing is pretty strong, right? So you got to be realistic about what it can and can't do for you. But the other thing I'll say about is having these sorts of sandbox tools, you've got to have a team who understands the output, right?
Yes.
This is not a fire and forget box. This is going to help a skillful investigator know what's going on. Which I think is important. You know, the other thing that I like a lot when we start talking about advanced malware is whitelisting on the endpoints. It can be a hassle to run, but I do think it's truly effective in most cases to have something like a Bit9, or there's a bunch of other vendors out there too, but to truly whitelist the known executables that you want to run, and everything else is just shut down. So even if the box is vulnerable and exploitable, it's really hard for that malware to execute on a box running appropriately administered whitelisting software. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying it's hard and makes it really difficult to when all else fails.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. That's another one of the really promising areas of malware defense, I think. And I suspect if we were to fast forward a couple of years down the line, we're going to see that concept be much more of the norm than it is today. Because I think right now, it's viewed as really onerous and high maintenance. But, you know, the amount of malware and the complexity of malware is, you know, it's growing exponentially. And there's going to come a time where it's just going to be too painful to maintain the status quo. I don't know that we're there yet, but the day is coming, right?
And I can speak to at least Bit9 because I know it pretty well. And this is not a commercial for Bit9. This is, believe me. But their administrative load, they've done a ton to address that problem. So, you know, there's a lot of things they do, like having a reputation service of, you know, every hash of every known executable, you can look up the reputation on it, and you can do some auto-trusting that way. You can trust certain updaters. So certain update code is allowed to update things, and then they trust the new updated hash. So there's some things you can do. Right, and it's interesting. I have not run Bit9 extensively in production, and I'd be curious what it's like to live with a Bit9 type product over a period of years. But I have been involved in a number of proof of concepts and a number of early initial deployments with customers, and I am a fan of the style of technology.
Yeah, my friend Bob will probably be playing with Bit9. In production at some point in the future.
Bob's a busy man.
He's busy. He's got a big team.
So let's fast forward slightly. We found that we've now got a box with advanced malware on it. What do we do?
Well, see, that comes down to philosophy. Because, I mean,
my philosophy is there's only one right answer, but go on.
the historical philosophy has been to take it off the network and, you know, nuke it and pave it and just get rid of it. But there is a significantly changing philosophy around this where, you know, we want to monitor what's going on. We want to know what other systems in the environment have they potentially compromised? What are they after? How long have they been here? How did they get in? How are they getting out? What are they, you know, what are they targeting? That sort of thing.
Sure.
And it really comes down to, again, it's philosophy. And I think we talked a little bit about this, and I think you actually made the very astute comment that says, if you don't have the resources in-house or aren't willing to pay for a Mandiant or, you know, a company like that, you're kind of left with just having to rebuild the system.
So it's the CFO's laptop, and he says, no way are you reinstalling my box. Just clean it off there. Can't you just clean it? Just remove it.
The answer is no.
That's the correct answer. I cannot tell you the number of arguments I've gotten into with people about, I'm just going to put this out there for the record. Once you've got a piece of announced mail around the box, I could never trust that box again, period, ever. Yeah. And soon I may not be able to trust the firmware sitting in the graphic card or the BIOS.
Oh, by the way, this is a watch this space. I'm kind of monitoring it. There's some chatter going on about a BIOS level worm.
I saw Rob Graham talking about that on Twitter, and
I didn't see Rob picked up.
Yeah, it was a very subtle sort of thing. I had to go do some tracking. Not that he was trying to be subtle about it, but he was just, it wasn't very sort of blatant, and I had to go figure out what the heck he was talking about. And but yeah, that'll get nasty.
I'm skeptical, but I'll keep an eye on it. Mm-hmm. And we'll see if that goes anywhere. But
back to, yeah, so I agree with you. You know, if you're willing to monitor, great. This gets into something we could spend hours just talking about, remediation technique and philosophy there.
Yeah.
Of, be careful what you do. Does it have a kill switch? Does it have, all that kind of stuff? Do you want to know what it's up to? But this goes back to, ideally, you've got instrumentation in place that once you know a box is popped, you can go back and say, all right, well, I want to look the last 2 weeks of network traffic from this device.
Right.
And that's a non-trivial thing to set up. But in that circumstance, you're going to love it if you can replay everything that box has done for the last 2 weeks.
Well, honestly, not having it in place is a business decision that mm-hmm. you are accepting the risk of not. And by the way, it's not necessarily wrong, right?
It's
just a business decision.
Every security decision, every risk mitigation decision is local to that company. There is not necessarily, as much as we like to say it, there is not necessarily a right or wrong anything, because everything is local to that particular business's needs and security concerns, right? And everything comes down to, what's the risk? What's the likelihood of that risk occurring? How much will it cost me if that risk does occur? How much does it cost me to mitigate it to an acceptable level?
Yeah. Yep.
And so we are speaking in terms of unlimited budget and a panacea, right? But the reality is most companies don't have unlimited budgets. However, it's a much more interesting conversation when you do. So,
I think there's an opportunity to kind of pick and choose, right? So if you think about all of the opportunities before you to mitigate the threat, right? They may not all work for you. Half of them might not even work for you, but there might be something in here that you could apply.
Philosophically, I don't believe you can stop it. So then it becomes a matter of how quickly can you detect it?
Yeah.
And limit the damage.
Right. Right. But I think there are,
you can make it harder.
You can make it extremely hard. And so one of the things I challenged myself with, and maybe I'll try to write this up as a blog post or something, but I tried to challenge myself to say, what would it take to get there? Right? Not that you could completely get there, right? But we can get a lot closer than we are today.
And stay there,
right.
Because business changes rapidly.
Yeah. I had a great conversation with an old friend of mine, and we were talking
Bob?
About industrial control systems. No.
Was
no.
It Bob?
This is not Bob, different guy. Somebody I used to know about four jobs back. We used to work on industrial control systems together. And he's gone off into the automotive world, and you know, I kind of gone off into this ridiculous security thing. And you know, we were talking about the concept of air gapping.
Sure.
And how I had heard a quote, and I'm not going to take credit for this, but air gaps are just a high latency connection.
That's awesome. I like it.
And it makes a lot of sense, because the point being, you know, when you design the system, it could be air gapped, and certainly, you know, things could be transferred through USB or whatever, but at some point you're not going to be there anymore.
Right.
And somebody's going to say, you know, this would be a heck of a lot more convenient if we plug this system into that system. And now your air gap is gone.
Did Battlestar Galactica teach us nothing?
Touche. Touche. So, you know, I think there are some significant advances, and I've got a whole lot of ideas, and some of these are really draconian. But again, it comes down to how much do you care about this?
Right. Well, yeah, it always comes down to what level are you willing to take it to? Right. Yes. I mean, you could go to thin clients, you could go to virtual desktops, you could go to, you know, there's so many things you could do.
But there are some simple things, like don't allow people to check their email, their personal email, on their work computer. Right.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing that amazes me, when you take a step back, right, if you were to kind of come into this, you know, into our society now kind of cold, you know, especially maybe having missed like the previous 20 years of PC history, it would be completely foreign that companies find it acceptable to let, you know, their employees use a business tool for so much personal work, personal stuff.
Yep.
You know, I think about what the work, you know, work office was like, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, you know, and I granted there were probably terminals, and the Unix hippies were doing crap on their systems. But, you know, the average person wasn't using company resources for personal stuff in general. I mean, sure, I guess they're stealing pens and crap like that. But it blows my mind that we find ourselves having this discussion about trying to manage the revolt if we were to prevent people from getting to Facebook at lunch on their work computer.
Yeah. But it's a very real thing. It's a competitive thing. I do think there'd actually be an issue with talent, you know, acquisition and retainment if you started shutting a lot of this stuff down.
I don't disagree.
It may be worth it. It may be worth it for your organization.
Right. And or finding a different way, giving them a tablet, giving them a virtual machine to do private crap in. Whatever, right? There's probably 100 different ways to solve that. But, you know, if you just reduce the surface area a little bit, you know, that helps.
It's true.
And, you know, some of the things I had, like on my personal email server, I found a script that for free will tell me if a link that somebody sent me is masquerading as something it isn't, right? So, you know, if somebody sends me an HTML and it's like, you know, here is, you know, AT&T.com, right? But it's, you know, something.ru, it changes it. It rewrites it and says, you know, phishing attempt. And then it says, you know, something masquerading as something else. And, you know, that's such a simple thing. And
yeah,
really effective. Blocking attachments is another thing.
Oh, man, you would cause some pain there.
I know. But
that's when people just go to Dropbox, man.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not trying to poke holes. I'm just saying that that's exactly like our first story, right? As soon as you block attachments and they got to get an attachment through, what do? Dropbox.
True. True. But, you know, you have to wonder, what is the net difference there? Because would phishing attacks be successful through Dropbox? You know, I'm not presupposing an answer.
That's an intriguing supposition, Mr. Bell.
I'm not presupposing an answer. I haven't entirely thought it through. You know, we're talking about this on the fly here.
Yeah. Because clearly, as our listeners can tell, we do a lot of prep work.
Well, I've got 3 pages of notes here.
I know, but I'm saying you and I, as in, we don't quote.
Oh, yeah.
We surprise each other on the fly, on purpose, by the way.
Right.
3 pages of notes. Dude, it's an hour show.
I know. Speaking of an hour show, we're a little over. But, you know, I think this has been a great discussion. And by the way, I want to go back because my page of notes about detecting, I only got about halfway through.
Well, you know what? Rouse them off, man. Buckle in, kids, for another 2 hours.
Honey pots. Honeypots.
I told you not to call me that at work.
Well, I know. But that was a long time ago. I think we can move on.
Oh, man.
So again, what do people do when they get their malware on your system, right? It's usually for a purpose. And if you set up a honeypot inside your network that people have no business connecting to, you know, that's a great opportunity to set off some bells and whistles. Hey, you know, that workstation over there just connected to our honeypot. There's something going on. You know, maybe it's even the employee, you know, snooping around.
You know, it's something like I was having a discussion, I don't know, with somebody not too long ago. We were talking about dummy records that are, you know, for lack of a better term.
Yes.
You know, I don't know what – there's a term, and it's leaving me right now. But the concept is if you ever see that dummy record show up, you know something bad happened.
I think they call them honey records, in fact.
All right. Well, okay, good. I'm glad.
Yeah, and then the other one was HoneyDocs. Have you seen the HoneyDoc project?
No.
Yeah, so there's this project called HoneyDocs. I think it's honeydocs.org, if I'm not mistaken. Either that or it's going to take you to some – horrific porn site. I'm not sure which, but anyway, the concept is that they you can take a document and they will add a tag to it that Excel and, you know, that the different office suites will in the background make a call out to this service, right? And so you get an alert, either an SMS or an email or whatever, when someone opens your document with, you know, when they opened it, what IP address they came from, you know, different information about their user agent and that stuff, which is pretty cool.
So they're embedding phone home malware into your document.
Not malware. It's basically like, think like a, you know, one pixel transparent image. I mean, it's
interesting.
Look, it's cool. Easy. It'd be trivial to prevent, right? If you were an attacker with a clue,
right?
You know, it would be trivial to get around. But you know, there was some controversy because I think it was Dropbox. In fact, somebody uploaded a HoneyDoc to their Dropbox account, and they immediately got a hit back because Dropbox opened it.
Oh, that's not very neighborly.
And in the ensuing kerfuffle, it was claimed that Dropbox opens it for the purpose of creating a, you know, basically an icon. So when you go to the site, you get a little icon about what's in the document.
Likely story.
A likely story.
Dropbox, that's right. Brought to you by the NSA. All right. What else you got?
Let's see. Another one. Monitoring, and I can't believe companies don't do this, right? Internal servers, monitoring for unsuccessful logins.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's just straight up good SIM management there.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Good security analytics.
Monitoring your, because we've been really focusing very heavily on workstation malware, but, you know, mm-hmm. it happens on servers too. Look. I see this so often, right? If you have an intranet server, don't let it talk to the internet. And not only that, but watch for attempts for it to talk to the internet, because it's probably a command and control channel. And now maybe you could open up some flows to, like, you know, Microsoft Update or something like that. Although not, you know, again, depending on risk, right? But, you know, there's an opportunity, a really easy opportunity. Another thing is, for your internet facing systems, do not have a path, either, you know, originating from your intranet or from the, you know, the external network, you know, between them. Don't do it. And, you know, log when there are attempts to get back and forth, right? Because we have seen, like, the state of South Carolina is the one great example. And the other one was DigiNotar, right? You know, they get owned from, actually, I think I'm mistaken about state of South Carolina. I think that was phishing. But DigiNotar for sure was a case where they got owned by a system on their web server, or by an application on their web server. They got into their database server, which was on their intranet,
right?
Which was a Windows system running on Active Directory. And, you know, all of a sudden they were everywhere. And speaking of Active Directory, my goodness, you know, I read a lot of news about compromises, and I'm really very, very interested in how these compromises break down. And there is one common thread I see among all of the ones that result in, like, major ownage, and that's Active Directory.
Where they get the Active Directory password file and go to town?
Yeah, and what the reason is that a lot of companies do the very smart, insane thing of removing administrator rights. Well, when you remove administrator rights, if somebody needs some work done, you have to have an administrator remotely connect to the system. And now you've got usually you've got a SAM file, or you've got some kind of cache credential that you can grab.
It's true.
And now you know, it's basically an effort in brute forcing the password, which is probably, you know, password 123 or something really easy, as we all know. And then you go to town. Now you've got an administrator level account that you can use to move throughout the domain. And you know, I don't have great advice on that, because it's like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you don't use Active Directory, it's nearly impossible to remove administrator rights.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates a whole host of problems on its own. So, yeah, that's a happy thought.
we're full of confident and helpful advice tonight.
But, you know, again, I think
this is the optimist hour.
I think there probably are some opportunities to segment your forest into different components, right? So maybe the administrator account that manages workstations doesn't have login authorities on any servers, right? So that might be a strategy. But, you know,
we might have to have a part two of Matt's malware defense strategies.
I think we're going to have a part two,
because we got many more to talk about.
We're way, way over.
Is that a subtle hint?
Yeah, I think so. So my family's home, and, you know, it's about to get really, really crazy in a couple of minutes. I gotta go do homework. And, you know, eighth grade math is my new thing. So
it's an exciting life we live.
It's an exciting life. Anyhow, I have thoroughly enjoyed this discussion with you.
Yeah, it's good times. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And hopefully our listeners, all four of them, enjoyed it as well.
Absolutely. And as usual, if you have any comments or questions, or, you know, you think we went astray, or you have other suggestions, drop us a note, info@defensivesecurity.org, or on Twitter @DefensiveSec. You can find me on Twitter @MaliciousLink. You can find Mr. Kellett at Lerg, L-E-R-G, not you. I don't know what to say about that, right?
I've had it forever. You know, it's four characters. How many of you will have four character names? Come on.
Fair enough.
And it actually, like, is, you know, human pronounceable.
Good point. All right. I wish everyone a pleasant week, and we will talk again next week. And,
thanks, everybody.
By the way, you know, you're past 10 podcasts now, by the way.
Wow. I think I won a bet.
You did. I lost the bet, by the way.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I'm happy to be here, and I look forward to the next 10.
Absolutely. We'll be at 50 before we know it. So
it's true.
Anyway, have a good night. We'll talk to you later.
See ya.
Bye.